Text us at 218-326-1234. And speaking of the text line, Heidi, I believe we got a text.
We did. This has to do with a movie. I did not know. I thought someone was just sending us some gibberish, actually. But of course, you knew. So that's good. The movie, actually, this text didn't say hello or anything like that. It just said Bubba Ho-Tep.
Great movie starring my good friend Bruce Campbell. What? And Ozzie Davis.
You also know Bruce Campbell? Oh, okay. And Ozzie.
Bubba Ho-Tep plays Elvis Presley in a retirement community. Ozzie Davis plays JFK. Huh. And a mummy comes back to life nearby the retirement home.
Sure.
And so they have to destroy it.
Huh. There you go. We'd love to. You're going to rewatch it, it sounds like.
I should. I have it on DVD.
Nice. 218-326-1234. We love hearing from you. We've got some more. Are you ready for movies?
Yes.
The movie The Witch is a
that's a great movie.
Super creepy, but not gory show set in colonial times.
It is one of the most atmospherically scary movies. Hmm.
Michael and Karen texted in, my choice for the Halloween movie would be the 1922 movie Nosferatu.
Ooh, that is a good
Symphony of Horror with Max Schreck. It is good. That one I'll get behind on that
I
one.
Saw that for the first time in 2020, I think, Halloween.
Oh, wow.
And now they've got a remake of Nosferatu coming out on Christmas Day this year.
Oh,
that Robert Eggers directed.
Huh. Wouldn't you think it should come out on Halloween?
I think but it should come out on Christmas Day. That's exactly my Christmas Day plans.
I see. There we go. We heard from Lisa, horror flicks are not my jam. That said, whenever I watch It's the Great Pumpkin, Charlie Brown, the trick-or-treat scene, and Charlie, I say repeat this all the time. You know, the kids are all going around. Did mm-hmm. you ever watch it?
Yeah, but it's been a long time.
Okay, they're all going around. They got their bags. They're shouting what kind of candy they've gotten. And every single time, Charlie Brown says, I got a rock. The horror. I repeat a lot of things from Peanuts. Like the Lucy, I say a lot of times, it's like Lucy pulling the football. This is what I'm feeling right now. Like when we're, you know, I'm engaged in conversation with people.
I think you should start saying good grief more, too.
Good grief. Huh. Yeah, I got a rock. Lisa, I'm on board for that one, too. That was such a fun one to watch. We love hearing from you. 218-326-1234. We're going to be talking with film professor Jack Nackbar about the film showing tomorrow night in Big Fork. And also Lori Schall checking in. She was at the Minnesota Lynx game last night. She'll give us the details on the winning game of the playoffs. They're headed to the finals.
And you are listening to 91.7 KAXE Grand Rapids and 90.5 KBXE Bagley Bemidji. We are Northern Community Radio, telling the stories of the people and land of northern Minnesota through music, news, conversation, and events. Operating translator K210DR in Brainerd at 89.9. Listen at KAXE.org or on your smart speaker. We need people like you to support this local media. Text the word donate to 218-326-1234. Thank you.
We are in election season and we're working hard to bring you information. You are invited tonight, KAXE and ICTV, with support from the Grand Rapids Big Fork Local 1314 Education Minnesota, are hosting a forum of the Grand Rapids School Board candidates. It's at the Rife Center. Meet and greet at 6:30. If you have a question you'd like us to consider to ask the candidates, email news at kaxe.org. And our election guide available right now with so much information at kaxe.org. It just went live yesterday.
And right on the front page. You can't miss it.
Yeah. It's unbelievable how much work our team has put in. Also want to tell you about a new occasional call-in program on Fridays at noon. It's called Dialed In, and it'll feature listener call-in, fact checks, local government, and election information and analysis with our news team. You can join me October 18th, 25th, and November 1st at noon for Dialed In on KAXE.
Now it's time for headlines.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Dave Mattingly. People in Florida are running out of time to evacuate ahead of Hurricane Milton. The Category 5 storm is forecast to make landfall late tonight or early tomorrow in the Tampa area. It's being called extremely dangerous and likely to produce a life-threatening storm surge of 10 to 15 feet in areas that include Tampa and Edgemont Key. Currently, the National Hurricane Center in Florida says Milton's top sustained winds are 160 miles per hour. The storm is expected to dump 6 to 12 12 inches of rain over a wide area, with up to 18 inches possible in some locations. The state of Florida has opened what are being described as mega shelters ahead of Hurricane Milton. Danielle Pryor with Central Florida Public Media says each shelter can accommodate thousands of evacuees.
Florida Emergency Management Director Kevin Guthrie says the four state-run shelters can house thousands of people.
Two of those shelters that we have already opened are Wiregrass Sports Complex in Wesley Chapel, Florida, and the Seminole Tribe Event Center in Tampa, Florida. I want to thank both of those private sector entities for their support in helping us protect Floridians.
All tolls have been lifted in Central Florida, West Central Florida, and Alligator Alley, and shoulder lanes are open in those areas to expedite evacuations. For NPR News, I'm Danielle Pryor in Orlando.
Hurricane Milton is prompting evacuations at some of Florida's hospitals and long-term care facilities. Governor Ron DeSantis says at least 10 hospitals in the state are reporting evacuations, along with about 300 health care facilities. It's been more than a century since the Tampa area received a direct hit from a major hurricane. An Afghan national has been arrested in Oklahoma on terrorism charges. The FBI says the suspect was plotting to carry out a deadly attack on Election Day in November in the name of ISIS. Here's NPR's Ryan Lucas.
The defendant, identified as 27-year-old Nasser Ahmed Tawhedi, was arrested on Wednesday in Oklahoma. According to an FBI affidavit, Tawhedi entered the U.S. in 2021 on a special immigrant visa and is currently on parole status pending his immigration proceedings. The affidavit alleges that Tawhedi and a co-conspirator, his juvenile brother-in-law, were supporters of the Islamic State and plotted to conduct an attack on Election Day in the U.S. in the terrorist group's name. Tawhedi allegedly sold his family's possessions ahead of the planned attack. Then this week, he and his co-conspirator allegedly bought two AK-47 assault rifles and ammunition from a contact who turned out to be an FBI source, leading to the men's arrest. Ryan Lucas, NPR News, Washington.
This year's Nobel Prize in Chemistry is scheduled to be announced in Stockholm later this hour. This is NPR News from Washington. The Justice Department says it may ask a federal judge to examine whether Google should be forced to sell parts of its business to eliminate the company's online search monopoly. 2 months ago, a judge ruled Google's search engine has illegally been exploiting its dominance, leading to less competition and innovation. Parents and child advocate groups are voicing support for lawsuits filed against the social media platform TikTok. More than a dozen states and the District of Columbia are suing, alleging TikTok is harmful to the mental health of kids and is designed to be addictive. NPR's Winsor Johnston says the states suing TikTok include California, Massachusetts, New York, New Jersey, and Louisiana.
The lawsuits argue that TikTok doesn't do enough to protect underage users from online harms. Mark Berkman with the Organization for Social Media Safety says the platform has too many addictive features that send kids down dangerous rabbit holes.
They employ what's called an infinite scroll, which is a design feature that continuously loads new videos for children as they swipe up. And that feature alone hinders a person's ability to accurately assess how much time they've spent scrolling.
The attorneys general also point out late-night push notifications that they say disrupt kids' sleep patterns, further exacerbating mental health issues. Winsor Johnston, NPR News.
TikTok calls the allegations wrong and misleading. Wall Street futures are on the downside this morning. I'm Dave Mattingly, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include Eric and Wendy Schmidt through the Schmidt Family Foundation, working toward a healthy, resilient, secure world for all. On the web at theschmidt.org. This is NPR.
Body certain, call
now is Nilu Furiana with the song Call It Love from her new album, My Method Actor. Big fan of that album. And you're listening to the Wednesday Morning Show. I'm Andrew DeZingle here with Heidi Holton.
We receive support from Ardent Bicycles in Grand Rapids, inviting the community to their new downtown location Friday, October 18th, with live music from The Consequences, Modern Day Wasteland, and Chris Holm. Festivities kick off at 3 p.m. More information at ardentbicycles.com.
And we receive support from ICTV. Stay tuned. Stay connected with ICTV. Learn more at watchictv.org.
Talking scary movies today, some texts coming in. Night House was Gary and Hopkins. That's a favorite of his, 2021. And Christine from 1983.
I love Christine. It's a perfect little commentary on 1950s nostalgia. Huh.
And our engineer Steve is telling us that the Star Trek, I can't really sit through horror movies, but there's a few Star Trek episodes that would make for some mildly spooky fare, one where the crew of the ship devolves into monstrous creatures and chases people around. Thanks, Steve.
And it is 8:13. You are listening to the Wednesday Morning Show, and the classic movie series continues at Edge Center for the Arts in Big Fork tomorrow night at 6:30.
This month's film is the 1976 All the President's Men, starring Dustin Hoffman and Robert Redford. We are joined, and Jason Robards.
Yes.
And we are joined now by Jack Nackbar to talk more about the film. Good morning, Jack.
Good morning, Andrew. Good morning, Heidi.
Good morning.
So, what?
I've got a couple of scary movies I'd like to mention before we talk about...
Yes. do tell.
More patriotic things. My nominations for what really scared me was in 1968, although I didn't see it till the 70s, Night of the Living Dead.
Ah.
Yeah, which was the first zombie movie, really, that started that whole fad. And that was pretty scary. And, excuse me, Night of the Living Dead, yeah. And Halloween in 1978, which was the first slasher movie and started that whole subgenre.
So, Jack, I was wondering, do you ever check out those Italian horror films, is it Giallo's horror films from like the 60s and 70s? The Criterion Channel has like a collection of them right now, and I'm diving into them, and they're little fascinating little movies.
Well, let's talk All the President's Men. I was so excited about this. It is one of my favorite movies. Why'd you pick it to show tomorrow night in Big Fork?
Yeah, and, about every 2 years, I try to get something vaguely political for October, that, you know, because the election is coming up within a month. And I thought, well, what could possibly be better than All the President's Men this year? The movie that chronicles two reporters working against the Watergate break-in in 1972, and eventually undid the Richard Nixon presidency, who, remember, Nixon resigned in 1974. And so I thought, well, that's a perfect choice for this year in particular, I think.
And one thing that I find fascinating about is that so the Watergate scandal happened in 1972, and this movie came out in 1976. So that was a quick turnaround for like such a current event.
Yeah, it was, and the reason was historically is the Washington Post got a hold of it with Bob Woodward and Carl Bernstein writing about it. And then they just doggedly and almost obsessively stayed on it and wrote some 400 pieces on the Watergate break-in and the succeeding plots to cover it up by almost everybody in the Nixon administration. And it was largely their work that led to that resignation, and it was just dogged and day after day after day with pieces appearing in the Washington Post.
Now, it also is in pop culture with Deep Throat. People just throw that around all the time. I don't even know if they know it came out of, I mean, it came out of the Watergate scandal, but I feel like the movie is where we really glommed onto that.
Yeah, Hal Holbrook in the parking garage, in the deep shadows, giving little clues to Bob Woodward in that movie, and he was actually a character in some of the stories that they wrote, a source of information. It wasn't until 2005 that we learned who Deep Throat was.
Yeah,
because he was an actual character in the reporting. But Deep Throat was a guy named Mark Feld, and he was the assistant director of the FBI at the time.
Wow. So your thoughts on Dustin Hoffman and Robert Redford in this film?
Right. And both those guys, kind of at the top of their popularity. I looked up the top 10 stardom things about the 70s, and both Hoffman and Redford were in the top 10 in six of the 10 years of that decade. And Redford probably was the most popular actor of that decade. He was number one for three of those 10 years. So, they were hugely popular and a good pick. And Redford was probably a necessity because doing the movie was his idea, it was his production company that made it, and it was Redford who gets co-producer credit on the film.
So a thing I find interesting about this time is like kind of. With Robert Redford, he doesn't really get classified as part of the new Hollywood wave that was happening at the time. But Dustin Hoffman gets mentioned in that group all the time, like with Robert De Niro and Gene Hackman. Why do you think Robert Redford just doesn't get quite lumped in? Was it just that he just started too early for that?
I think, yeah. Hoffman was a little bit earlier, with The Graduate in 67, I think. And so he got a little bit earlier start. But Redford was largely seen as, I think, just this really handsome guy and kind of a dreamboat character, whereas Hoffman had the much more eccentric, weird parts to play and much kind of different roles, and so I think there was some differentiation there. Then Redford got his reputation, probably a lot of it through Sundance and new movies that were playing there and at that festival, so I think there was different. They were from different directions. As the characters do in the movie, by the way, is Redford, Bob Woodward character, started off, well, probably maybe always has been, a bit of a conservative, and he came from a judge in his family, and he'd gone to Yale, and he was, you know, kind of a WASPy character. Whereas the Carl Bernstein character, his parents were members of the Communist Party, and he was kind of a political radical. So the characters are in personality and political ideology some degree apart, but they learn to work together on this project.
You know, what I like about this film is that it shows how important journalism is to a democracy. And there's some other, like, I absolutely adore the film Spotlight as well, because it's also showing kind of the work, hard work of journalists and what it can uncover for people.
Yeah, Spotlight. Just for the fun of it, I looked up people's things are, what are the top journalism movies, and some people think Spotlight is in the top five, and maybe deservedly so for unleashing the knowledge of the sexual abuse scandal in the Catholic Church. So that one is deservedly a creditable work of highly creditable work of journalism, as all the president's men and the Watergate reporting was.
Did, when it came out, Jack, when it came out in 1976, was it a popular film?
Yeah, it was the second most popular film of the year at the box office. It did over $70 million worth, which was huge at the time. And it was second only to Rocky, the little movie that's made about a million sequels. And Rocky also in the Oscars was named the best picture over All the President's Men that year. But All the President's Men got 8 Academy Award nominations and won 4.
So yeah.
Well.
Jason Robards won Best Supporting Actor that year. And, like, I got to say, this movie, they don't make them like this anymore where it's just a who's who of character actors in this movie. You got Jack Warden, you got Martin Balsam, you got Hal Holbrook, Jason Robards, Ned Beatty. Like, I miss just having character actors supporting a movie like this.
Yeah. Ain't it the truth? about 2 pages of interesting character actors who played in this film. People who are guilty in the scandal. The newsroom, which was a careful recreation of the actual Washington Post newsroom. They researched it and duplicated it exactly for this picture on the Warner Brothers lot, or 2 lots, I think. It was a huge set, and so lots of talented people who you may have seen before playing roles in a movie that is really trying to duplicate history as closely as possible.
The film is showing tomorrow night. It's at the Edge Center for the Arts in Big Fork, the classic movie series. It's All the President's Men from 1976, free and open to the public, and a cartoon before?
A cartoon before, absolutely, and some previews of the November movie afterwards, just like going to the movies.
Oh, I love it. All right. Thanks, Jack.
Okay, always a pleasure to talk to you folks.
You too.
Yeah, thank you, Jack.
Coming up, we talk Lynx with Lori Schall. This is the Wednesday Morning Show.
Now I'm going to play a song for you. This is Sister Sadie with Blue as My Broken Heart.
Little bird sitting up on a wire, singing your song like your soul's on fire. It's an all too familiar tune. I feel just like you. Echo of a freight train whistle blowing, crying all night and no one knows it. Lonely on a one-way track, I feel just like that. Ooh. tree. You take a little rain and you keep on growing. You're stronger than you thought you'd be. You're just like me. You're just like me.
And that was Sister Sadie with the song Blue as My Broken Heart here on KAXE KBXE. You're listening to the Wednesday Morning Show. I'm Andrew DeZingle here with Heidi Holton.
That's right. Coming up, we're going to talk Minnesota Lynx. We would like to thank our business supporters, and that includes Bagley Area Collaborative, offering community exhibits, workshops, and many upcoming events, announcing fall classes beginning in October with the Farmers Market Basket Workshop, October 11th, Colored Pencil Workshop, October 22nd, a Scandinavian Snowflakes Workshop, November 14th, and Needle Felting, December 7th. All are welcome, bagleyarts.org or on Facebook.
And we receive support from the Mental Health Crisis Response Team of Itasca County. This crisis intervention service is a program of First Call for Help 211. Provides free crisis assessments, stabilization services, referrals, and resourcing to residents of any age who are in crisis. They're available 24 hours a day, 7 days a week by dialing 211. And Minnesota Lynx defeated the Connecticut Suns last night. Our photographer, Lori Schall, was at the Lynx playoff game last night, and she joins us now to talk about it.
Can we just go, woo!
Woo! How about those Lynx?
Oh my God. Lori and I talked yesterday and we both admitted how nervous we were for the game last night.
We were so nervous. Yeah. Yeah. Because, you know, we haven't really beat the Sun by many points. Like it's usually been a nail biter. And last night was just, whew. What did you think, Heidi?
Well, I was so nervous about that, how close the points are, where normally you'd think, oh, we're 10 points ahead. We got this. You can't do that with the Connecticut Sun. You know, the last game, I thought the Lynx were going to win if you just watched the first half, and it went sour. And so after halftime, when it came back and they kind of started to do a similar thing, I was not enjoying that part at all. How was it when you were there feeling that?
Yeah, that was like, a little scary when I came back into the stadium and we just had that a slow start in the third. But then we just like, we're like, I think it was just this collective, nope, we're not going to do that. That's not going to happen to us this time, you know, and yeah. We just picked it up. I think we had like maybe a 12-point run or a 10 or 12-point run after that.
Yeah.
But yeah, we had such good defense. Boy, it was a sellout crowd. It was a really energetic crowd. It was really fun to be there.
Mm. Yeah, what was the atmosphere like inside?
It was great. I mean, there was Lindsay Whalen was there. Did they show that? And Angie Craig and Tina Smith were there. There was a Vikings player who was there right now. I don't remember his name. But yeah, it was kind of like celebratory, you know, it wasn't the nail biter. So it was kind of like we could celebrate a little bit. And it was really energetic.
So Lori, some standout moments for you in the game or players that you enjoyed?
Well, Nafisa Collier, I mean, she's just so good. She had 27 points, you know, and I think watching her and Courtney Williams play together is really fun. Williams had like 24 points, and so just the two of them were on fire. They were like in sync, so that was really fun to watch. And McBride was hitting some of her threes. So I don't know. I'm trying to think if there was a standout moment. That's a good question. It was just a standout game, you know? Yeah. I think we were ahead by 24 points at one point in the game.
You know, the broadcast of it, they were talking to Coach Reeve right after Collier had gotten maybe the three-point, not Collier, Courtney had gotten a three-pointer, I think, that was kind of a surprise because she usually is hitting two from that same spot. And so they mm-hmm. went right to the coach, and Collier and Williams had like kind of high-fived or low-fived or something like that after that play as they headed down the other way. And the coach was mad. She's like, stop celebrating every basket. She was so angry. And it was like, you could see that it did kind of change. She must have been telling them that on the bench to not celebrate so much that we're not there yet. So
yeah, because we know what could happen. I mean, yeah, they are very unpredictable, the Sun. But yeah, it was just good to see that how well they did and how in sync they were.
Well, and how fun for the playoff to be all five games, you know, that we got to see all of those, even though it made me very nervous. What happens next and what are you thinking?
Oh, yeah. So on Thursday, we do not get a rest. So on Thursday, we play in New York. And so we need to prepare for that. And you know, we have a good record against New York, 3-1. And we won the Commissioner's Cup against them.
Oh, yeah.
But, you know, they seem to be in sync. New York seems to be in sync. And they have a lot of MVP players and really experienced players. So it's going to be tough. I'd like to see us pull it off in three, but I don't know if that's possible or not. But, you know, we'll see. We'll see. What do you think? What are our chances?
I'm a little nervous, but I forgot that we had beaten them a few times. But when they're on, Brianna Stewart and Ionescu, oh my gosh. And no, not Kelsey Plum. She was on the Aces and they lost. She's a force though to watch. I'm excited. So they had two games in New York and then they would come back to Minneapolis. Is that how it goes?
Yes. Two games in New York. I don't know. I can't remember when the second game is, but it might be Sunday, but I'll have to check.
Yep. It's Sunday.
And then they come back. Okay. Sunday.
Yep.
Yes. And, I believe we have tickets for the home games already.
Oh my God.
So
nice.
Yeah. So we got to take advantage of it.
Oh my gosh. I went one year to when they did not win the title, but it was like the team, I can't remember what year it was, but they lost by one in overtime. And it was, it's still one of the most heartbreaking moments. It was awful to walk out with all those Lynx fans. We were just, it was way too much.
Yeah, that is a major heartbreaker. Yeah.
Yes, but I don't think it's going to happen. I think we've got a really good shot, and we're very excited about it. They'll play Thursday night, so we'll get to talk about this on the sports page on Friday.
Awesome, yeah. I'm sure all the guys were watching last night.
Uh-huh, me too.
And they'll have a lot to say.
I got to work on it a little bit, I think.
A lot of good insight.
Yeah. Thanks, Lori. Glad you had a good time. We'll keep us posted.
Bye, Lori.
Will do. Hi, Andrew.
Talking Lynx this morning, along with scary movies and apples and all things northern Minnesota, including news. Coming up next, it's our news team's Up North Report.
For KAXE News, I'm Larissa Donovan with the Up North Report. A portion of the Boundary Waters Canoe Area Wilderness is now closed because of another wildfire in the region. The Shell Lake Fire is about a half acre in size and is burning timber. It is suspected to be human-caused, but an official fire investigation has not yet occurred. The fire has the potential to spread to the east near Agawato Lake and a portion of the Sioux Hustler hiking trail. This trail and three campsites nearby are closed to the public, along with the entry point on the lake. Northern Minnesota is facing drought conditions, causing active and increasing fire across the landscape. Federal and state firefighters have responded to several human-caused wildfires in recent days. A Cloquet Bridge is at risk of sudden collapse and is closed until repairs are completed. The Superior National Forest announced in a news release that the Cloquet River Bridge on Langley River Road has integrity issues due to June's flood. The center pier of the bridge is scoured, meaning stream sediment like the sand and gravel around the bridge's foundation washed away from fast-flowing water, creating holes. The bridge is closed to all traffic, including pedestrians and ATVs, with more information on storm impacts on the Superior National Forest website. Four tribes in Minnesota received federal funding to address violent crime and the opioid epidemic. Senator Tina Smith announced the funding for seven tribal public safety initiatives as part of her work as a member of the Senate Indian Affairs Committee. The Leech Lake Band of Ojibwe, Red Lake Band of Chippewa, Mille Lacs Band of Ojibwe, and White Earth Nation received funds ranging between $450,000 and $900,000 for various tribal programs. These programs will be tailored to each tribe's unique needs, like White Earth expanding tribal court capacity for home visits and supervision, and Mille Lacs hiring staff to investigate child abuse and neglect cases. Senator Smith says the grants are, quote, directly supporting tribally driven solutions to challenges like violent crime and the opioid epidemic. Red Lake Chairman Daryl Seeke says with funding from two awards, Red Lake will be able to, quote, expand services for children who may have been victims of crime in a culturally based and trauma-informed manner, as well as provide medication-assisted therapy at the Red Lake Detention Center. Leech Lake Tribal Police Chief Kenneth Washington says Leech Lake's funding will be used for additional staff to help respond to the opioid epidemic. The November election is 1 month from Tuesday, and Minnesota is part of a new multi-state poll that draws feedback from rural voters. Mike Moen has the story.
The firm tapped by the Rural Democracy Initiative reached out to likely voters in 10 states, including Minnesota, and economic issues top the list of concerns. Minnesota resident Sharon Gunderson lives in East Bethel, a small city north of Minneapolis. She was not part of the poll, but says she plans to support Donald Trump this fall because of his economic vision. She's still concerned about consumer prices, and she feels the current administration is pushing too hard on the transition to clean energy.
Electric vehicles, you should have everything electric. We don't have the power grid to handle that. And it takes common sense to know that.
But according to the poll, not all rural voters share the same views on specific aspects of the economy and which candidate is best suited to handle them. Kamala Harris holds a slight advantage when asked who is trusted to lower housing costs, support small businesses, and foster a tax structure that benefits the middle class. Residents from key battleground states such as Arizona were also part of the new RDI poll. Tristan Young, a voter from the Grand Canyon state, says neither major party candidate has an agenda he feels would impact him personally. But as a father, he says supporting Kamala Harris is the best way to go in this election.
I have three black daughters, and I feel like it would inspire them. And that's my reasoning.
As for the poll, Harris does enjoy more support among BIPOC voters from rural areas. Donald Trump has the overall edge among rural voters in this survey. However, 73% of Democrats from smaller communities report feeling more enthusiastic than usual about voting, compared to 63% of Republicans. I'm Mike Moen.
From the KAXE News Desk, I'm Larissa Donovan. KAXE's election guide is now available at KAXE.org, where you can find more of our stories of northern Minnesota through local news.
The Up North Report on KAXE is sponsored by Woodland Bank, dedicated to serving local businesses, families, and nonprofits in our area since 1920. You can find more information online at woodland.bank.
And you're listening to the Wednesday Morning Show here on member-supported KAXE. Coming up in a little bit, we got Area Voices, my conversation with author Steve Hoffman about his new book. And then at 9 o'clock, we're going to hand things over to Gina the Knife for On the River. Wait, I'm Andrew DeZingle.
I'm Heidi Holton. Coming up at 2 and 10, it is New Music with your host, Kari Headland. And we've got tonight at 7 o'clock On the River as well, hosted by our volunteers. And that is TBD. we'll look it up and we'll let you know.
Support for KXE comes from the Minnesota Historical Society. The Forest History Center in Grand Rapids is now open Fridays and Saturdays from 10 a.m. until 4 p.m. Fall hours, including horse-drawn trolley and kayak tours, run through October 19th. Tickets and more info at mnhs.info/forestautumn.
Mickey P is our host tonight for On the River. You want to tune in for that. Mickey always puts together a great mix of music. You know, if you are, you have a favorite volunteer, you like to catch shows and you want to know who's on, did you know you can find it at our website? Look for volunteer opportunities and the calendar's right there. You can find out who would be hosting. While you're at that website, the new election guide has gone live as of yesterday. The news team putting together so much information that cannot be found anywhere else. Check it out at KAXE.org.
I don't want to brag, but me and my coworker Heather Johnson, we were the first two to use.
Oh, the I think you do want to brag.
Pretty exciting. Support for KXE comes from the Grassroots Concert Series, presenting Larry Long and Peter Watercott on Friday, October 18th at 7:30 p.m. at the Live Well Nightclub and Coffee Bar in Nisswa. Doors open at 6:30. The full fall lineup can be found at grassrootsconcerts.org.
We also would like to thank Green Heron Bed and Breakfast, a four-season B&B on Pacagama Lake, featuring home-cooked meals and all the amenities needed for a complete family vacation. More information at greenheronbnb.com. It's going to be another beautiful day today. Is that correct?
Yes, it's going to be a beautiful day. Sunny, high 66 to 72 degrees, south-southeast winds at 5 to 11 miles per hour. Gusts getting up to 21, though. Tomorrow or tonight, mostly clear with lows 41 to 47. But tomorrow, things are going to heat up. Sunny skies, highs 78 to 83.
It's
a little too
warm
for October. You said you're going to do it. You have to do it now.
Okay. Coming up next, it's time for Area Voices with Andrew DeZingle.
My name is Andrew DeZingle, and I'm the producer of Area Voices. Sometimes in life, you just need to take a giant leap into the unknown. And that's exactly what author Steve Hoffman did years ago, and he talks about it in his new book, A Season for That, Lost and Found in the Other Southern France. We talk about his own personal journey of actually writing this book, but first I want him to describe in his own words, because he is an author, what this book is about.
The book is a description of our family, our Minnesota family's six-month extended semester in a tiny winemaking village in the Languedoc region of southern France. We went there because our two kids, because I'm a Francophile, Francophone for my whole adult life, and we had our two kids go to French immersion school in the Twin Cities as a result. And this trip was initially really designed primarily to put the kids in a local French school, have them sort of cement their language skills after years and years of commuting to the east side of St. Paul and doing Raffi songs in the back seat. We wanted to get our money's worth by having our kids actually speak French when it was all said and done.
So how did you pick the town that you ended up staying in?
It was somewhat intentionally whimsical, to be honest. My wife and I had done a lot of traveling previously, and we kind of liked the sense of adventure of sort of under-planning a little bit and then living by our wits when we arrive. And so we knew we wanted to be in France because this was meant to be a French-speaking adventure. We wanted to be somewhere warm because we're from Minnesota, and we thought it'd be nice to spend a late fall, early winter somewhere warmer than the Twin Cities. And so at that point, it was going to be the south of France, and Provence and the Riviera on the east side of the Rhone are expensive and heavily touristed, and the Languedoc on the west side of the Rhone is less of each of those things. So we thought we could afford it and to check all the other boxes. And at that point, you know, this was pre-Vrbo, pre-Airbnb, and so we just started kind of sending out digital requests into the ether and got one back from this tiny little village from a landlord who was willing to rent to us for 6 months and accept our family, you know, for that whole time. It fit our family, fit our house. And from there, it was kind of flying blind. We arrived without really knowing a whole lot about where we were, what this place was about, what this town was about, really what this part of the world was about.
So back up a little bit. How did you like become interested so much in the French culture?
I took French throughout my schooling. So I started taking French in sixth or seventh grade, took French class as part of my language requirement throughout school, middle school, high school, and college. And I had a sort of a gift. That's too generous a word, but my mouth was able to pronounce French fairly well early on. It's nothing I can take any credit for. It just happens to be that way. So I kind of took French in part because it was an easy way through school. Also because my choice when I was given the language choice was either, you know, as a Hoffman, it made more sense for me to take German, but I just thought French was prettier. But then I took my junior year off of college, lived in Paris for 9 months. And that was really the transition point. That was kind of the fulcrum that where I switched from being a semi-reluctant but fairly good French student to being an enthusiastic lover of France and the French language, really, and became a speaker of French at that point. And I think part of what also happened in Paris was that I got a first glimpse of what it was like to live in a world capital as a, you know, a fairly uninteresting teenage, late teenage kid from, you know, the suburbs of the Twin Cities. Suddenly I had this vision of myself as a world citizen, as a sophisticated person striding the streets of Paris, and feeling as if this is a version of myself that I really liked a lot and actually preferred to the version that I'd been stuck with for 21 years. So a lot of my then adult relationship with France was an effort to kind of recreate that feeling.
Yeah, and I think that goes throughout the book, the whole idea of what a vision of ourselves we want to be, but then finding out that, like, life doesn't work out that way. It, like, it happens the way it's meant to be, kind of thing.
Correct, correct. And to some extent, you're stuck with who you are no matter how much you try to escape it. I think that's one of the other messages. And so, you know, there's kind of the two poles, the polar experiences in France for me, which is the Paris experience that in some sense taught me that I wanted to be somebody other than who I was. And then this, the experience that's described in this book, which is really a coming to terms with embracing who I was, because who I was had made a bunch of choices that resulted in our being in this place, but also my being a part of this family that I, in some sense, as silly as it may sound, I kind of rediscovered my own family by going abroad.
So when did you figure out that maybe this could be made into a book?
Well, if you read the book, you understand that my wife has strong opinions about things. And she, what happened really was I started keeping a journal during that trip. That journal turned into several articles that got published in the Minneapolis Star Tribune in the food section. And then those articles ended up being nominated for several national food writing awards. And in those discussions where it became clear that I might end up going to New York or somewhere else to attend a food writing awards ceremony, she's like, you should have a book proposal. So it was once again as sort of simple and unplanned as that. And I generally listened to her advice. So I began imagining what it might be to write a book or to at least start planning a book. And that was the beginning. And then at some point, you know, it has now taken over 10 years for me to get this in print. I spent those 10 years, you know, wondering if I'd done the right thing, wondering if this was ever going to get published, really learning to write a book at the same time that I was writing a book, sort of, you know, preschool and graduate school simultaneously. So it was really that initial suggestion. And then at some point, it was just like, I'm so far into this, I'm going to see it through. And it was by the end, it was just really a lot of sheer stubbornness to get through to the finish line.
You are tuned in to Area Voices. I'm talking with author Steve Hoffman. So I thought it was also interesting because you get personal about yourself in the book of, like, there's certain moments that really stuck out to me, like you talking about your phone call with your parents and saying you thought your dad made some mistakes and then getting the phone call back. Like, was it hard, like, exposing yourself in that way?
Yeah, that was one of the hardest, some of the hardest decisions that I made, because my relationship with my parents is tricky and has been for a number of years. There have been long periods of silence and lack of communication. There's been a lot of misunderstanding. And again, I felt as if that was a part of the richness of the story to include, you know, why I'm in such a search for family and relationships and connections, and why I feel this sort of a fatherly mentor-mentee relationship with our next-door neighbor in the book, who turns into, you know, a very influential figure in the story and in my life. I felt that as if there needed to be some background there. And that's another case where early versions of the book had either a lot more of that or a lot less of it. And I tried to, again, be as respectful as I could while still writing the story that I felt needed to be written, or writing the story in such a way that it worked as a story that was going to inevitably involve my relationship with my first family, but I tried to once again say things in such a way that if they were maybe potentially slightly hurtful, they were still done out of a place of respect. But yes, that was maybe the hardest decision in the whole book, because it would have been easy just to leave all that out and not ruffle any feathers, or to kind of have it be a little bit more like, well, I finally get my chance to say all this, and then have it be almost a personal essay style, dish all the dirt kind of family of origin story. And in the end, that didn't work. That wasn't the story that I wanted to tell. So I had to find the sort of the just balance. And it was a very, very difficult series of decisions.
And I think it's to the benefit of the book, because like you said, you could have easily left things like that out. But I think it gives the reader a better chance of, like, if you're willing to share that information, that the rest of the book, this is what you, as you remembered it happening, like, you're not going to sugarcoat what happens throughout the book kind of thing.
That's a really interesting way to put it. I really appreciate that. I haven't heard it put that way, but I think I agree that there's a certain sort of proof of concept there that, like, okay, one question any reader is going to ask is, why am I going to trust this narrator? How do I believe what they're saying or not saying? And I think, yes, making myself vulnerable, making myself not look that great in some of those scenes, and also then, you know, talking through some of these more difficult eras of my life are a way of generating some credibility with the reader, where they're then going to believe that, you know, by the end, it's a little bit of a fantasy story, although, as you, I'm sure you can tell, it's very hard-earned by the end. But there is this sort of few moments of grace at the end of the book. And if those just happened, then it's just, a sweet little travelogue. But there's no real emotion behind it. And I think having those bad times inform the later good times in the book makes the good times much richer emotionally.
What are some things that you've taken home with you since making this trip?
Well, one thing is a food writing career. You know, it really started then and has since, you know, blossomed into certainly a parallel career, if not as lucrative a career as my tax preparation. I think there was definitely a shift, a sort of seismic shift in my understanding of my relationship with France, which was going from that early young man's kind of ego-driven wish to be a better and more admirable person when I was in France, to having France teach me other lessons about the place of food and wine in daily life and the importance of that being shared with people you love, as opposed to food and wine being another way of showing off, of showing that you are sophisticated, or that you have a relationship with France, or that you know about great wines and can talk about them. This was a much humbler place, and the lessons I learned were much humbler as well. And they really brought my focus back to food, wine, and cooking, which I'd always been fascinated with. This trip taught me that food, wine, and cooking are ultimately, again, about people you're making happy rather than performance, rather than cooking at people is an expression somebody used recently. And I really love that idea, that I'd spent a lot of my life cooking at people, satisfying my own ego, trying to show off a little bit. And this taught me about cooking for people, which is a much different experience. But in the end, it's been much richer. And, you know, cooking together as a family, or cooking for each other, is just a much deeper part of our lives now, because it's enmeshed in our daily life and not a show-offy kind of performance.
And so how does it feel for you personally that, having been working on this for 10 years and now there's like a physical book that you can hold in your hand, you can put it on your shelf, how does it feel to, because I think people take for granted like kind of the work that goes into books. Books don't, especially how many, all these pages you had to fill, it just doesn't come out of thin air. You've accomplished like something that so many people say they're going to do but have never done it, but you did it.
It feels like a little bit like the end of a marathon. You don't ever want to do it again the minute after you're done. And then you realize, oh wow, I've really done something important and big. That's kind of how it feels. It's interesting, by the time I held the book in my hand, I had already gotten feedback from some early readers who'd read the initial galleys before the final proof was done, the publishable version of the book. And so I started to get some feedback. And honestly, I thought that holding the book in my hand was going to be the big moment. And in the end, it was a nice moment. It felt great. It did sort of put a physical period at the end of that sentence for me. But honestly, by far the greatest part of this has been some of the comments I've gotten about people where all of those years of being alone in my room, no feedback, not knowing if this is going anywhere, not knowing if I was even telling a story or what a story meant. I really struggled for a lot of those years. And there was quite a few of them when I was not sure this is ever going to get published, in part because I didn't know if I was capable of it myself, in part because I didn't know if the publishing world was going to be interested. And I've gotten some comments about people who, a friend of mine literally said that his mother was dying and he picked up my book as a way of dealing with that, of getting through the day in a really terrible time of grief. I've had other people say that they've laughed out loud or cried in the first 50 pages, or that they've read passages out loud to their spouse as they're moving through the book. Those kinds of connections, that it's such an unlikely thing that I can put words down and that those words are going to connect me with someone I will never meet in my entire life. And yet there'll be this emotional moment between the two of us remotely. That kind of connection is just magical to me. And having those kinds of comments come through have been, I think, maybe my favorite part of having finished the book.
So where can people find the book and keep track of your food writing?
So my website is just www.sjrhoffman, as in Stephen John Raymond Hoffman. My Instagram is the same, at sjrhoffman, and I'm very active on Instagram. So you can kind of see behind the scenes a little bit or get to know me a little bit better. I post fairly frequently, and it's not all just photos. I do some writing there as well. The book itself is available, obviously, on Amazon, as everything is. But most independent bookstores are carrying it as well. And it's called A Season for That, Lost and Found in the Other Southern France. And I would love to hear from anybody who reads it and hear their thoughts. As I said, that's been my favorite part of this.
Steve Hoffman has been my guest today. Area Voices is made possible by the Minnesota Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund. You are tuned in to the Wednesday morning show here on KAXE. And just a little bit, we're going to hand things over to Gina the Knife for On the River. We receive support from Paul Bunyan Communications, Northern Minnesota's certified Apple Service Center in